If you're listening to this while under a general anesthetic, well, obviously you're not. Obviously you've just woken up. You've just woken up from a general anesthetic. Perhaps you're back in the ward after your procedure. Perhaps you're in intensive care, or perhaps you're still quite worryingly on the operating table. Now, if you are still on the operating table and you've woken up, take a look at the surgeons around you. Study their faces, because you want to figure out, have they just woken up too, or were they awake the whole time and performing the operation on you? Because my concern about these general anesthetics is that they're a bit too vague. Now, this anesthetic, they say this thing is going to turn off your entire body. Every inch of your body will be put to sleep for the length of the operation. They have local anesthetics and then they have general anesthetics. So who's to say that a general anesthetic is capable of recognizing the perimeter of your body? If the general anesthetic is too powerful, it could spread to other bodies in the room. Your surgeon might have been put to sleep. So for all you know, you've just woken up during surgery. You've no way of knowing whether those doctors and nurses and surgeons around you have all been awake for the whole time. Look down, see have they opened you up yet. That would be a good clue. If they haven't opened you up yet, they haven't done anything yet, that means they've been asleep the whole time that you've been asleep. Now, the problem I understand from a general anesthetic is that you don't know how long you've been asleep. That's the one type of sleep that happens where you can't keep track of time at all. From what I understand, when they put you under for surgery, you wake up a nanosecond later in bed and you say, oh, when are we going down to surgery? And they all stand around laughing at you to say, oh, look at this fucking idiot. He doesn't realize you've already performed the surgery on him. Will we tell him? No, keep him guessing for a while. To be fair, his guessing equipment, namely his brain, probably isn't at full mast yet. It's still ramping up. It's not working properly yet. He's just waking up. So give him an hour or two to think about it and figure it out. And then we'll ask him again, do you think you've had the surgery yet or not? And then if he says, no, I don't think you've done the surgery yet. Why would you? I'm still in bed. Although that's a bit weird, because when you put me under, I was on a trolley just at the entrance to the surgery. Was it cancelled or something? Did you put me asleep and then find out it was cancelled and then decide to send me back up to bed for a nice sleep? Well, it's not a nice sleep if I wake up from this. You're wondering, have you installed my artificial, whatever it is you're installing, my pair of iron lungs? I don't know. Do they have artificial lungs now? They probably do. They've had external iron lungs for best part of half a century, as I understand it. They had iron lungs many decades ago. So surely by now they can give you an artificial lung that you put inside you and you don't have to carry around on a trolley or sit inside a barrel like you used to have to do with the iron lung. Anyway, if you're on a general anesthetic, that's what you need to worry about. I don't know if you ever have this experience. You're doing something where you're sitting on your hand for some reason and your hand goes numb. Your hand falls asleep. And then sometimes a couple of your fingers are more asleep than the others. So it's vague. It's very hard to direct a particular part of the body to go asleep. So why would it be any easier to direct anesthetic towards your whole person and nobody else in the room? No, it'd have to be magic to do something like that. That's why they make the anaesthetist sit at the opposite end of the bed to where your head is. Oh wait, is that true? Do they? Maybe they don't. Well, that's a problem then. If the anaesthetist is sitting just behind your head, they're going to be the first to fall asleep if your anaesthetic is slightly more than it should be and it spreads beyond your body. I suppose that's an incentive for them to be very careful about the dosage. Keeps them on their toes, I suppose. So there's that. Anyway, if you're listening to this after waking up from a general anesthetic, welcome back to the land of the living. I hope you had a nice little sleep there. I know it doesn't feel like you had a sleep. It feels like 5 seconds have elapsed, even though you've listened to 6 minutes of this podcast. when you go to the dentist and he gives you the gas, he pumps this gas into your mouth, fills your mouth up with this gas. It's a bit like that foam they use to put out fires sometimes. They pump foam into a building to quench the flames, and that helps in some way. They do the same in dentists. They pump and pump and pump this anesthetic into your mouth. You can't really feel whether it's overflowing, or at some point your face goes numb and you're enjoying yourself. You're thinking, oh, this is great. I haven't been to a dentist since I was 3. It's nowhere near as bad as I thought it would be. And then you start half nodding off. But you've no idea that your face is so numb. The dentist has overfilled your mouth with foam, and now it's spewing out through your mouth onto your, I hope he's at least given you a napkin. It's flowing out onto the front of your clothes. Anyone who walks in there now, at that moment, who doesn't realise that it's a dentist surgery, perhaps a window cleaner outside or something who sees that will think you've got rabies. Because that's what people with rabies do. They foam at the mouth. They foam, their mouth fills with foam. And then it overflows. They've no control over it. It flows all the way out of their mouth and down on them. And that's how you recognize someone who has rabies. It's the same with a dog. If you see a dog that's foaming at the mouth, that's a rabies dog. It's not a normal, ordinary dog. It's a rabies dog. And a rabies dog is a very different kettle of fish to your bog standard average dog. And of course, bog standard average dogs come in many different varieties, even when they're not rabied. There's a whole spectrum of dog. There's the little yappy dog. There's the big, huge, giant, man-eating dog. And then there's the dog in the middle, maybe a collie or one of those lassie dogs. They're kind of in the middle. Nobody knows what to make of them because they don't go around eating people's heads off. They're not small and yappy. They're not overcompensating for their small stature because they're of medium stature. They have a bit of modesty. They don't go around barking and biting people's heads off. No, they say, I'm a dog. I know my place in society. That's what those dogs are like. The medium-sized dogs. Now, I know there are aggressive dogs who are medium-sized, and there are aggressive dogs who are small-sized. Well, if it's a small-sized one that's aggressive, you can pretty much ignore that. It'll just nip part of your ankle off. It can't get its jaws around your whole leg. It's not jaws, for one thing. It's not a shark. It's a dog. Now, if you had a baby shark, why would you have a baby shark? You wouldn't. You wouldn't have a baby shark. Why would you have a... Well, you maybe have one in here. I haven't had a fish tank in about 15 years. I don't remember whether people buy baby miniature sharks and put them in their home fish tanks. Maybe they do. Maybe they do. I'm just not aware of it if they do. Because people keep snakes. And I think there's probably people in America or somewhere who keep crocodiles or alligators in their garden pond. Is there? Maybe there's not. There's definitely people who keep wild cats of the type that are more similar to lions and tigers than domestic cats. There's a few people who keep those, and they're fucking terrifying because they look a bit like your favourite home domesticated cat, but they have fangs. As soon as they open their mouth, you go, oh Christ, that's not a standard domestic cat. That's a monster. There's a reason you don't see a wild dog section in Dublin Zoo. Because they're just not that interesting. And they're not that terrifying that you have to put them in cages. They're no more terrifying than your, well, than your banned dog breeds that people get sometimes to eat children's heads off. Those are terrifying. All I'm saying is the wild version of a dog is no more terrifying than that. You can get the same amount of terror from a domestic dog as you can from one that would be in the jungle. The same is not true of cheetahs and lions and tigers. People don't have pet cats that are on a par with lions and cheetahs. They just have those miniaturized ones that are like a miniaturized tiger. They look absolutely perfectly normal until they open their mouth and they kind of hiss and kind of growl and they show their fangs. Well, why would you want a cat that you're afraid of? Maybe you've been a long time cat owner all your life. You're used to having cats. And you have friends who are afraid of cats and you want to experience what your friend experiences. So you get a cat that you're afraid of just to see how the other half live. Well, that's a problem because you're responsible for that cat, whether you're afraid of it or not. So you're going to have to learn to stick up to that cat. Are you prepared to stand up against a wild cat who's being shrunk and put in your house? So if you're not, you should apologize to your friend who's afraid of cats. You've done this whole ridiculous experiment just to make them look stupid. That's no way to treat a friend of yours. Don't treat your friends like that. Assuming you have friends, do you? You probably don't. Do you have friends? Well, you might have more friends if you stop doing weird experiments where you get a wild, aggressive cat miniaturized and bring it into your home just to test your friends. They're already probably afraid of your normal cat. You don't have to push it. Don't push it. There's going to be some talk on the program today about getting your tail run over. I just wanted to warn you up front about this. I don't want to preempt it. Suffice to say, anytime you're getting your tail run over, it's going to be a surprise because your tail is behind you. But you get an awful shock. But your tail is like the... Again, I'm in danger of preempting it. If getting your tail run over is something you have a phobia of, just be warned, we'll be talking about getting your tail run over. Now, I suggest you grin and bear it and listen to it because you might learn some helpful advice for dealing with your phobia. If it's such a phobia that bothers you every day, then you should probably consult with your medical practitioner first. Ask them, should I go ahead and expose myself to this thing where your man's going to talk about my worst fear, getting my tail run over? Should I listen to that or should I wait until I've had some therapy with a phobia expert? Because your doctor might think, no, don't rush into it. I want you to see a phobia expert first. There was an episode of Criminal Minds where there was this fella. He was this psychiatrist or something, very serious looking psychiatrist, wore stern glasses and a shirt and tie and carried a briefcase. He looked very like Michael Douglas in Falling Down. Now, if you haven't seen Falling Down, that's really good. It's a movie from the 80s or 90s. Michael Douglas plays this businessman who's having a bad day at the office. In fact, his bad day at the office has ended with being sacked from the office and everything's going wrong. So he decides, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. Except he doesn't use those exact words because that's from a different movie called The Newsroom or something. So he doesn't say that. It was pretty much like that. Except he goes berserk. Goes on a rampage, starts shooting people up. But for the whole day that we see it having this breakdown, everything he does, he's still wearing this shirt and tie. I think he's wearing a short-sleeved shirt. He's got stern glasses, thick-rimmed. Looks a bit like Stephen Colbert if Stephen Colbert wasn't as friendly looking as he is. That sort of thing. So anyway, this episode of Criminal Minds is a psychiatrist or psychologist or something who looks very like him, like Michael Douglas in Falling Down and like a non-friendly version of Stephen Colbert. He looks like that. Turns out he's a serial killer. He specializes in patients who have phobias. He brings them in, he says, what's your worst phobia? And then he brings them down to experience their worst phobia. If it's fear of being buried underground, he buries them underground. And then he stops and writes a little note in his notebook and he watches them die. And then he goes and finds someone else with a different phobia and makes them die of their phobia. And that's why it's an episode of Criminal Minds, because all of that stuff, of course, is illegal to the point of criminality. It's not even a minor offence. But it's a proper crime. It's not a misdemeanor. I think you Americans have misdemeanors. I think you do. We don't have misdemeanors here. If you do a small bad thing, it's not called a misdemeanor. It's called an offence. But then if you do a big thing, if it's a big fucking deal, it's called a crime. And I'm pretty sure the things your man was doing to those patients who he murdered. Well, clues in the statement, isn't it? Murder is literally a crime just about everywhere on the planet. Even in the undeveloped world or the overdeveloped world, murder is a crime almost everywhere. Well, we do have slightly different definitions, but they all involve killing people. So it's a global talking about the law a lot of the time. You have to remember everyone lives in different jurisdictions, and he can't be taking advice from some fella in one jurisdiction about what to do with the other side of the world in another continent. But with something as basic as murder, it's pretty much safe to say that if murder is a crime here, it's most likely a crime in your part of the world, so you'd be well advised not to do it. Might well be against your religion as well. Don't they have that thing in some religions, they go, you're not to be mean to your neighbour's wife or your neighbour's cat, and you're not to cover anything, and you're not to cover that gun, and you're not to act on your coveting on that gun and go and get the gun, because that's stealing. That's thou shalt not steal. And when you do steal that gun, which thou shalt not do, thou shalt not kill with it. Thou shalt turn the other cheek. That's not one of the Ten Commandments, but there is a thing. Turn the other cheek. If you're going to shoot someone who believes in turn the other cheek, the best thing to do, I suppose, would be to shoot them point blank right in the middle, so they can't say, oh, that's, he's got me on the left cheek, I'll just move now a bit and he can get me in the right cheek. No, you shoot them right point blank in the middle. Now, I don't recommend you do this, because one, it's illegal, and another, it's a fucking horrible thing to do. You don't do this. But if you did do this, hypothetically, if you shot someone right in the middle of the nose, and there was one of these people, maybe like Ned Flanders of The Simpsons, they portray him as a religious freak because he believes in loving your neighbour and shit. That's considered weird outside of the major religions. If you're like Ned Flanders, you say, oh, this fella shot me. Wait, but he shot me right in the middle. How do I turn the other cheek? It's right in the middle. I suppose best you can do is say, he's missed both of my cheeks, so I'll just pick a cheek at random and turn that towards him. And then, of course, that means you have to turn your other cheek then. If he shoots you right in the middle and then you let him shoot you in your right cheek, then you have to turn the left cheek. And that seems unfair, because you're prepared to do the turn the other cheek thing that you've been commanded by your maker. You're a good person for doing that. But now, because he got you right in the middle the first time, you have to get two more gunshots, one to your left cheek and one to the other, just because the fella happened to have very good aim and got you right in the middle. That seems a bit unfair. Well, I suppose the whole turning the other cheek thing is unfair. You are the victim. It's not about being fair. I mean, if he didn't have good aim and he just hit you in the cheek the first time and then you turned the other cheek, that doesn't mean you deserve to get shot in the other cheek either. So, it's not ideal. But there are a lot of things from those religions that I think are good. The whole thou shalt not kill thing, as a general rule, I think that's a good thing. Love thy neighbour, well, that depends on your neighbour. What if they're a cunt? What if they're an absolute fucking cunt and you hate their guts, and you have good reason to hate their guts? I suppose you're supposed to turn the other cheek there as well. So you're supposed to voluntarily go to him and present your face for being shot into. If I say, wait, I don't even have a gun. I don't want to shoot you. I'm just a cunt who you don't like. You can't go turn the other cheek. I wasn't shooting you. Wait a minute. Does the turn the other cheek thing, I suppose that's not automatically about being shot. Maybe someone's slapping you in one cheek. Actually, now that will make sense. Because 2,000 years ago, they weren't all going around with guns, shooting people's cheeks off. No. There was probably a slap in the cheek. He said, oh, he slapped me in the cheek. I'm going to turn the other cheek. And of course, he wouldn't do as much damage with a slap. It's still bad. It still probably hurts like hell. But no, that's not too bad. If you're listening to this while sitting at a typewriter, or typewriter, as you normies call them, I call it a typewriter. So that's the way I was brought up. I pronounce it typewriter. People who hear me saying that, who aren't used to hearing typewriter, will probably say, oh no, that's not how you pronounce it. Well, no, I pronounce it typewriter. Same way I did when I first learned the word when I was about 4 years of age. I'm quite happy with that pronunciation that I learned around 1980, when this was a typewriter world. We had typewriters everywhere, all over the place. We hadn't switched over to computers and smartphones yet. We still had typewriters everywhere, all over the place. So I trust the pronunciation that I learned in that era, in that world, because it was of that world. It's like if you went to some other planet today and you had a vehicle that they called, let's say they called their vehicle a plim rocket. That's just a made up word, but let's say they call it a plim rocket. You wouldn't go home and say, oh, look, they pronounced their vehicles wrong. They pronounce it plim rocket. You would not, because it's their world, it's up to them. The same is true of the typewriter. People in the typewriter era in the past are best placed to dictate how it should be pronounced. In that era, nobody had a computer in our house. We had just got our second television channel. We got our second television channel at some point, either before I was born or not long after. We got our second television channel, and that was the most computerized part of our house. There may have been a timer on the electric oven, and that's really just a glorified alarm clock. It wasn't digital or anything in those days. And of course, we had a doorbell. Nothing more digital than that in the house at the time. So anyone else who wasn't there in that era to decide how we should or shouldn't pronounce typewriter. No, we didn't have a typewriter, but wait a minute, why am I claiming then that I'm in a position to say how typewriter should be pronounced? I suppose you have a point there. I'm calling it a typewriter because that's the pronunciation I learned in that era. I lived in the era of typewriters, so I trust the pronunciation that I learned in that world more than whatever you kids who grew up on Twitter call it. I may not be the perfect, most reliable source for that pronunciation, but it's definitely more likely to be correct than your pronunciation, because you grew up with PlayStation 6s and tapping stuff on the screen. I grew up in a world where when you bought a newspaper, as we did every day, that was typed up on a typewriter somewhere. So we're calling it typewriter. Anyway, if you're listening to this sitting at a typewriter, perhaps you're J.R.R. Tolkien and you're typing away at your... I know you're to your first immediate thought there is to think, but I'm clearly not J.R.R. Tolkien. Well, just suppose for a moment that you are. Have a bit of imagination. This is theatre of the mind. Assume for the moment that you are J.R.R. Tolkien and you're sitting there at your typewriter waiting for inspiration. Now, was he the fellow who wrote all that fantasy stuff? I think so. Stuff about goblins and monsters and people going on missing. I don't like that shit. I'm nothing against J.R.R. Tolkien. May he rest in peace. I assume there is somebody called J.R. Tolkien, because J.R.R. Tolkien had to add an extra R to distinguish himself. He was a very wealthy man by the time he got to his later years, so he could easily have gone to J.R. Tolkien and bought him out and bought the rights to be called J.R. Tolkien with just one R for simplicity. He could have done a swap, I suppose. Of course, when you're swapping things, they need to be of equal value, so he'd be swapping his name, J.R.R. Tolkien, with someone whose name was J.R. Tolkien. And of course, the one where only one R is the more valuable. Anyway, if you're listening to this at a typewriter, why? Why are you at a typewriter? Maybe you're... Let's see, why would you be at a typewriter? Maybe you're writing to your publisher, or your would-be publisher, telling them, I think I should get one of those word processing machines. You know those word processing machines? It's a thing with a screen attached to it, and you have a keyboard just like this typewriter, except it looks better. Now, if you're in the typewriter era, probably your idea of a word processing machine is whatever the first Apple thing was. What was the first Apple thing? I don't know. I didn't have an Apple computer until a year and a half ago, so I'm not well up on this, but I presume the first Apple thing was, oh, it was probably shaped like an apple, was it? It was probably the whole machine was shaped like an apple. It's a beautifully designed device, had a stem coming out of it, and that was part of the cable that connected it to the mains. The first couple of inches of it were brown, so it looks like the stalk of an apple, and then the rest of the electricity cable was transparent. You couldn't see it unless you were looking very hard, so it looked like it was just the stalk of an apple. At night, it would light up because you'd see the electricity going through it. Very entertaining. You wouldn't want to have kittens or grown-up ginger male cats in the house if you're going to have that, because they'd chew that to bits. But otherwise, no, I'm sure it's lovely. I'm sure it was lovely looking, your apple-shaped computer that you had back in 1984. Of course, it never occurred to you. Never occurred to you. You hadn't read the book 1984 yet, because nobody read that until a few years ago. So you didn't know, wait, this is that year when I'm supposed to be worrying about everything. I'd certainly be worrying about a lot more important things than what type of writer I'm using, or what shape my Apple AMAC, or what was the first Apple called? I don't know. I don't know the early history of Apple computers. I think there was a device called an Apple II. So I presume there was a device called an Apple I, but it wasn't originally called an Apple I. It was just called Apple, just like with World War I. It wasn't called World War I when it was going on. It was called the Great War. You had to stipulate every time, of course, because we hadn't had 80 years to digest the meaning of World War I yet. So everyone had to be reminded every day. Every newspaper article you read would start with a little footnote saying, please note, although this is being referred to as the Great War, that is not meant as an editorial statement about how good the war is. No, this means it's a big deal, a big fucking war. It's not necessarily good. Suppose that depends on the outcome. Although now we have reports coming in of 8,000 men having their face blown to bits, so it's probably quite bad. So increasingly likely that we'll come down on the side of the Great War being a bad thing. But we try to keep an open mind, because this is the 1910s. We still have journalism and unbiased fact reporting and keeping an open mind. Of course, can't be too open, because they're all having to use these typewriters. They're using these mechanical typewriters. They're not even plugged into the electricity. Like driving a car that hasn't got automatic, or riding a bicycle where you have to shift the gears all the time and there's no power in it. So they don't have power steering or anything like that. That's what a mechanical typewriter was like. If you made a mistake on a typewriter, you had to go, oh Christ, and you'd stop, you put everything down, you tell yourself, calm down, it's just a mistake, you can correct this. You'd put down your tools, you'd put the typewriter down on the desk, you'd leave the paper, well, you'd probably, I don't know, would you probably type to the end of the page or something before you correct it? You probably would. You'd finish that page, or at least you'd finish that line, and then you take the paper out and you get a bottle of Tippex. I believe you Americans call it whitewash. From the Huckleberry Finn story, the one that starts with Tom Sawyer being punished by having to whitewash his parents' fence. So I presume that's what you Americans think Tippex is. It's also a solvent that your teenage children used to sniff. So highly dangerous. Make sure they're not doing that. That's as bad as sniffing glue. Do you remember they used to sniff glue? I don't either. I never saw someone sniffing glue in my whole life because it never mixed in those circles. But I remember people used to talk about the kids sniffing glue. In fact, there was a song in the 1990s by the Britpop band Pulp that went something along the lines of, help the aged because one day they were just like you, smoking fags and sniffing glue. But it was the mid-1990s and the idea of sniffing glue was already so passé that it's something your grandfather did. So let's say you're a teenager in the mid-1990s. Your grandfather, how old are people's grandparents in a normal family? I don't know. My grandparents were nearly all dead by the time I was born. We're not a normal family. My parents created me quite late in their own lives. So if you're a normal family, I presume your grandfather is something like 40, 50 years older than you. Would that be right? So let's say your grandfather probably grew up in the 50s, which means your grandfather is somehow younger than my parents, if that's the case, because my parents grew up in the 1930s. So I don't know how to advise you on this, except to say that if you have people talking about sniffing glue in this day and age, introduce them to the idea of word processing. They'll think it's great. They say, oh, that's great. And then they go tell everyone, my great-great-grandson bought me this computer and I'm learning how to type on it. You don't have to use paper. You can just type straight into it and it comes up on the TV in front of you. It's great. And of course, then they'll find out he didn't buy the computer for them. He just brought it over and you're being invoiced. You get an invoice from CompuStore or something. I know CompuStore closed down a long time ago, but I presume someone else has bought the name and is using it to trick your grandparents or whatever. So someone bought the name CompuStore and they'll probably bill you. Same thing happened with Iceland. In fact, the new Iceland is already gone. There was an Iceland, the little frozen food supermarket from England. They set up in Ireland at one point and then they went bust. They all closed down. And then a couple of years later, someone else bought the name and opened up another chain of smaller, but there was more of them, Iceland shops. Then they went away. So now we're waiting for the third coming of Iceland. If you're a fan of Iceland, you're waiting now for the third coming of Iceland to this country. I don't know if it's being announced yet or if it's going to happen, but we're waiting. We're waiting joyful hope for the coming of the next Iceland, and I hope they get it right this time. It's getting a bit much if they go broke every 5 minutes. Nowadays, well, before the internet was big, but I'd say back in the 90s, if you had a car and you were quite mechanical, you were working on your car, you look into a problem with the engine, you could go down to your local library. Your library had a whole section that had a handbook for every popular make of car. I remember these. People used to go to the library. They'd take out a book about whatever their make of car is, and they'd use that to do any repairs they had to do. They'd figure it out. They'd find out what parts they need and stuff. And of course, that's all gone away because you have the internet now, and we also have cars that are like something NASA would build, so nobody knows how to fix their own car anymore anyway. But I suppose in those days, God came along to you and said, I want you to build an ark. It's a type of boat. You couldn't go to the library and look up the different makes of boat. For one thing, an ark is not a make and model. An ark is not the boatular equivalent of a Toyota or a Ford Taurus or a Cadillac Eldorado. No, a boat is a generic term, and an ark is supposedly a generic term for a particular category of boat. I think we all know nobody had ever heard the term ark before that. People weren't going around saying, oh, what type of boat do you have? It's an ark. Oh, that's great. Is that better than a yacht? Is it like a barge? Can you sleep on it? Does it have sails or a motor or do you row it? What's an ark like? Nobody heard of an ark. It wasn't a thing. Especially not people who didn't live by the sea. They were flooding the whole planet, remember? So the vast majority of the people who were going to be flooded had never even seen the sea. So they didn't know what types of boat there were. Even if arcs did exist, they wouldn't know anything about it. They know nothing about it. And now they're supposed to have a crash course. No. I suppose that was the whole point. God didn't want them to all build arcs. So he kept it obscure. He says to Noah, there's a type of boat called an ark. Don't tell anyone else about it, but you'll find here's the plans for how to build an ark. Make sure when you're finished, tear up the plans and either don't burn them because you're on a wooden ship. You don't want to be burning things on that. No, tell you what you do. Tear up the plans after you've memorized them and then eat them. I'll make sure it's on a non-poisonous papyrus. I should probably use non-toxic writing implements as well. What can you write with in that era that's non-toxic? I don't know. I think anyone who starts flooding everything is a bit toxic, to be perfectly honest myself. But I'm sure he had his reasons. We'll just flood everything. Fuck it. Flood everything and start again. I'm going to keep two of everything. We want every species to be able to start again from scratch. So we'll have two cats, two dogs, two giraffes, one man, one female, presumably. Did they have Noah's wife on that? They probably did. And then you had two of everything. The aviation industry, of course, now is based on that. They have redundancy because they have two of everything. If you're halfway across the Atlantic on a 737 and one of the engine blows, you know you have another engine, so it's no problem. As long as you have one engine still working, now that, of course, can't reproduce. So that's the problem with the Noah's Ark thing. it's not really redundancy if you have two of everything, because you need to have two of everything. If one fails, that's no use. The other one can't reproduce on its own, unless you do some crossbreeding. So no, it's not entirely the same.
Once upon a time, there was a dog.
Now, it's been a while, I've just realised, it's been a while since I've explained for new listeners why I do this dog thing. Why I do this dog thing? Of course there's a reason. There's a reason for everything. I don't just come along and say, I'm just going to say, once upon a time there was a dog, and then repeat dog 10 times. No, there's a reason for it. I'm not just doing it for no reason. About a year ago, absolutely a year and a half, after I brought this podcast back from a 7-year absence, I discovered I liked sitting here and saying the word dog into this microphone while I'm wearing these massive studio-style headphones and have the bass turned up. I like the way it sounds in my ears when I go dog. And in fact, when I started doing that, I was going, once upon a time, there was a dog. A dog. So I did that for maybe 10, 20 episodes. I did that. I'd start a segment with, once upon a time, there was a dog. A dog. I'd say that a few times. And I'd enjoy even how my mouth felt doing that. It was similar to the sort of enjoyment I get from eating a hot sauce that burns the mouth off me. It was like that. But then I decided my new narrative would be that I'm getting a bit too old to be doing the dog thing. That involves contortions of the mouth is probably killing me. So I thought I'll stop doing that and I'll switch to going, once upon a time there was a dog. A dog. I think that was sometime in the spring of this year, was it? Or was it in the winter? I don't know. Either way, anyway, every episode or two, I start a segment by just going, once upon a time, there was a dog. Basically a dog. And this dog, he was sitting by the side of the road one day, minding his own business. He was sitting on the curb, sitting like a humanized dog would. Even though he wasn't a humanoid dog, he was one of these dogs. He'd had a lot of exposure to Family Guy and comic books where they have talking dogs. His sole idea of a dog was that they're all humanoid, that they could sit like a human, which they can. If they put their minds to it, they can. It's just probably not very comfortable. But he was sitting like a human child would, using the curb as a seat, with his back paws dangling out in front of him over the curb, probably touching the road. It's probably very hard to do that as a dog, isn't it? If you're a non-humanoid dog, and all dogs are non-humanoid in real life, there are no humanoid dogs. If you see a humanoid dog, that's not real. That's someone in a dog costume. It's not even a normal dog costume. It's a humanoid dog costume to make them look like a humanoid dog. Or else they've got a monkey or something and they've changed it to... Because a monkey can do humanoid stuff. A dog can't. No, a dog couldn't do that. A dog couldn't do that. And yet the dog in this story is doing that because he's a can-do dog. So the dog's sitting there on the curb, his hind legs dangling in front of him. I'm not sure which way a dog's hind legs bend now that I think about it. For this to work, they'd have to be... I suppose either way, you can just have them. Oh, just have them, you know. It's fine. Whatever way it works, he's going to be uncomfortable anyway. So he's clearly decided he's fine with being uncomfortable. Or else he decided he's not fine with being uncomfortable, but it's the only thing he knows. He was brought up as an only dog. It's like being an only child. Except you have dog siblings, but you were taken away from them at a very young age. You were adopted by humans as a puppy. You've never lived with other dogs. You've only lived with humans. You're an only dog. And in fact, you're probably in a house that has an only child. And this only child
is your only exposure to how one of the kids or puppies in their family should sit. Of course, being an only child, this child has had no one to show them how to do it properly. The only child had to make up how he sit on the edge of a curb. Of course, if his parents had been paying attention, they would have told him, you don't sit on a curb at all. It's extremely dangerous. Do not sit on a curb unless your parents are rich and they've bought the whole neighborhood and fenced it off and put gates everywhere so there's no traffic coming into it. In which case, it wouldn't be very interesting. There's no traffic going by. Maybe the child or the dog don't care about that. And of course, there's no child in this story. It's just a non-humanoid dog whose only exposure to dog behavior has been, well, he hasn't had any, so just being the other child in the family who happens to be a human sits like that. So the dog sits like that. Now, where the child learned to sit like that, I don't know. Didn't learn it from his parents, I can tell you that much. Why would parents teach their child how to sit on a curb? They wouldn't. It'd be extremely irresponsible. Sometimes children learn things from sources other than their parents, unfortunately or fortunately, depending on the circumstances. Sometimes that's a good thing, sometimes it's a bad thing. Sometimes it's just nothing. It's just nothing. Not everything is good or bad. Sometimes they pick something up like, oh, the children might learn that type of cloud is called a cumulonimbus. And that's neither a good thing nor a bad thing, knowing the name of a type of cloud. No, I suppose it's a bad thing if the information they've learned is inaccurate. Maybe that type of cloud isn't the cumulonimbus. They've learned incorrectly that it is. It doesn't really matter if he doesn't act on that information. So the difference is, if the child picks up the bad way of irresponsibly sitting on the curb, that's a bad thing. That's a lot worse than getting the name of a cloud wrong. Clouds don't need names anyway, unless you're a meteorologist or an airline pilot or something. You don't need to know the names of clouds. We don't even know the name of our own moon, most of us. We know the names of moons that go around other planets, but we don't refer to our own moon by name. We just say the moon, because everyone knows if you say the moon, oh yes, you're talking about the moon that goes around Earth, obviously. In fact, I suspect that if you were part of the first colony to set up on Mars and you went there, Mars has its own moons, I assume. I'm not sure. Let's say it does, for the sake of this conversation or monologue, if you like to see it like that. For the sake of this monologue, let's suppose that Mars has its own moons and they've got names, because we're very good at naming other people's moons, just not our own. I suspect that if the Earth colony set up there, they would still refer to Earth's moon as their moon, and then they'd refer to Mars's moons as either Mars's moons or whatever the names we have for the Mars. I suspect they would do that. Because when you're away from home, you don't suddenly start referring to your home as that house that's at the end of that cul-de-sac in that town there. It's a house that's called Puppy Cat House. Well, I used to live there before I went away for a few days. Like, I will live there again when I come back from my holidays. No, you wouldn't talk about it like that. You just still call it my house. And I think the same is true of the moon. Of course, that hasn't been put to the test yet. And I don't know if it ever will. I'm not sure that any of us are ever going to go to the... Oh, wait, I was talking about Mars, wasn't I? Oh, Mars, yes, Mars. So Mars, yes. I don't think we're going to Mars. We sent robots there. We've sent... What else have we sent to Mars? Did we send a car? I think we sent an electric car to Mars. Or did he just put it up into space? Your man who bought Twitter, didn't he put a car into space or something? Absolute waste. That's what he is. And then he went and got this car and he put it into space. When Henry Ford invented the motor car, I know he didn't invent it, but he came along with the first mass-produced motor car. Did his marketing people decide, oh, I'm going to throw our car into the sea as a marketing thing. We'll throw it into the middle of the Atlantic and we'll film it or something, or people can look at it on telescopes. No. Apparently now, if you're going to space, that's de rigueur now. If you happen to also have a business that involves going into space, I'll throw this car up into the place you're least likely to need a vehicle of any kind. Except for a spaceship, I suppose. Something to keep the air in, I suppose, at least. I know you Americans with your air conditioning, you're very big into this thing where if you have a car with proper air conditioning, you love to tell people, no, don't open the window. The air conditioning works better when we're sealed in like a fucking box of sardines. What was this? Was this the dog story? Oh, yes, the dog sitting on the curb. The dog's still there, sitting on his curb, dangling his legs off the curb, using his tail for balance. His tail is sticking out behind him onto the footpath. Probably going to get accidentally walked on by some bypassers. Well, because this dog, he has his tail. These animals, they have their tail. We're told it's one of the most important part of their living equipment on this earth. When dogs are incarnated on this earth, the first thing they tell you is, this is your tail. This is very, 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 very important. It's one of the first things you're going to learn how to use. In fact, a lot of it will be just instinct. It'll come to you naturally how to use this tail. You need to protect it. Very important. Everything about this tail. In fact, most mammals are told this. They say, watch out your tail. Your tail is very, very, very important and precious. Don't let that kid who you live with play with it. And certainly, certainly don't leave it flopping on the footpath behind you while you're sitting at the curb. I mean, it's bad enough that you're dangling your feet out in front of traffic. While you're doing that, your tail could be trod on or cycled over by one of these bicycle people or these new things now, the e-scooters. You get an e-scooter coming over to your tail. Is that what you want? No. And your instinct won't help you with that because e-scooters were only legalized here in the past year or two. You don't have any recorded genetic instinct of how to deal with an e-scooter, so you have no idea until it runs you over. So then you get your tail run over, and because you're sitting on the curb facing out into the traffic, you feel a wheel going over some part of your body. You think, oh Christ, have I been hit by a car? Your tail is usually what tells you what's going on. Your tail will tell you, oh yes, you have been run over by a car. Or no, you're fine, I'm still keeping you balanced. Your tail is damaged, your tail tells you nothing. So you have no idea what's happened. You try to communicate with your tailing, just no response. No response. It's like about an hour ago, the battery ran out on my laser mouse. I think the kittens might have been playing with it overnight, I'm not sure. The battery ran out on my laser mouse and there was no response. And that's what it's like to have your tail run over. You don't have a visual on it. You only have the tail signals coming from your tail to tell you that it's being run over, and your tail can't do that because it's being run over. And that's a huge problem. It's a huge, 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 huge problem. And that's why most of us chose not to come back as dogs. If you're listening to this from inside a birdhouse, I don't mean you're a bird. No, I just mean you're listening to this from inside a birdhouse. And obviously it's not a real birdhouse because no human being could fit inside a real birdhouse. Unless you mean the bird building at the zoo. I don't. I mean a birdhouse. So obviously it's a replica birdhouse. It's a replica model of a birdhouse, made to 100 times the scale of a normal birdhouse. Maybe you're a birdhouse manufacturer and you have a big birdhouse out in front of the factory on the front lawn so passers-by can see that you're the birdhouse factory. You can't just put a tiny little normal-sized birdhouse out there. It'll just melt into the background. You want it to be seen from the public highway. So you make an extra-large replica of a birdhouse. I suppose that counts as a real birdhouse. A birdhouse that's too big for its normal purposes. And even then, even a joint birdhouse like that, a bird could fit inside that, of course. So, could it still function as a birdhouse? I don't know. Would a bird feel like it was a birdhouse? I don't know. If you got an apartment that was a replica of your current apartment, let's say cost isn't an issue. Someone says, would you like an apartment that's a replica of your apartment, but built to 100 times the scale. So it's 100 times the size of your apartment. Would you be able to use that as an apartment? I'm not sure you would. For one thing, you wouldn't be able to reach the front door with your key. be 100 times higher. You need a stepladder for that. Even if you own a ladder, that wouldn't work. You need a ladder 100 times the size of your existing ladder. If you even own a ladder, which you probably don't if you live in an apartment. If it was a house where you owned a ladder, because maybe you're one of those freaks who cleans their own gutters and windows and you don't care that you might break your neck doing that. Yeah, a model of your house built 100 times the scale. That ladder isn't going to help you at all. Unless the ladder increases in size with the size of the house. Well, why would you do that? I've just made you a house that's 100 times the size of your house, but I've decided that's not enough. I'm going to do the same with all your belongings for you. No, you're probably going to do it as a surprise, as a birthday gift or something, so you don't even know whether they're going to appreciate it. And they probably won't, because that's not practical. They're not even going to be able to reach the door handle. But if you are doing that, you might think, maybe we'll make everything to scale. We'll get all your belongings. We'll make a replica of each of your chairs and your television and your sofa and your bed and your welcome mat. So that's a lot of extra work. In more ways than one, a huge gift to give to someone. So no, you're not going to do that. Anyway, let's say you happen to have a ladder that's 100 times the scale of the normal ladder. And you use that to reach the door handle and you put the key in. If you can manage to lift the key up, it probably weighs a ton. And that's just to get into the house. It was supposedly a comedy movie. I think it was called Downsized or Downsizing or something. It's about this couple. They're in the world where someone's invented a way to shrink human beings down. So they shrink them down to a tiny size and then they go and live in a luxury retirement village that's so small they can fit it into a small piece of property, so it costs very little and everyone can just retire and go and live on this miniature property as long as they get shrunk. Now, spoiler alert, they go and arrange to be shrunk down and the wife chickens out at the last minute, but the husband does get shrunk down, so he goes and lives in the retirement village. But then about an hour into the movie, I can't even figure out what happened, but it went from being a comedy movie to being something involving this fella going to Europe. I can't even remember what it was. I was so confused. If you ever are watching Downsized, you're going to be about 50 minutes into it, and then you're suddenly going to think, wait a minute, did someone spike my drink? Because it's very weird. I'm not sure I even finished that movie. It's like someone got two movies and stuck them together. It was like back in the 1980s and 90s, I remember. We used to watch consumer affairs television programs. If you go to buy a used car, there's a danger that it might be two used cars stuck together from two cars that have been in a crash. And they just get the front of the car and the back of the car and kind of weld them together and paint over. Apparently, that used to be a big problem in the second-hand car market. Well, that's what the movie Downsized is like. The front of it is a quite novel and entertaining comedy setup. And then halfway through, it just turns into something else entirely, and I still don't understand what it is. And no mechanic is going to be able to help you with that.
Into your head.
If you're a scriptwriter, say, for example, you're writing a two cats walk into a bar story for this podcast. There's an occasional segment I do on here. You want to have the cat talking to the barman and not to the other cat. If you have two cats walk into a bar, as I do sometimes, I go, two cats walk into a bar. One of the cats goes straight up to the bar counter and says, hello, can I have a pint of your finest Guinness, please? And then the cat and the barman interact and they have an interesting conversation. In that conversation, the barman is fascinated because in this world, you don't get to talk to a talking cat a lot. So the barman is really there on behalf of the viewer. If you're writing a film script or a scripted podcast or perhaps a TV drama or a sitcom, no human is going to be interested in watching an hour plus commercial breaks of two cats talking to each other about nothing. They have nothing to say to each other that's of interest to us. No, you have to have the cat talking to a human and the human will ask the right questions. He'll be there on behalf of the viewer. So he's representing the viewer in that scene and getting all the good stuff out. The US version of The Office, the situation comedy, there's this young fella there. The fella who ends up marrying the receptionist, I forget his name, fellow with the messy hair. He's constantly looking at the camera and raising his eyebrows. He's in there on behalf of the viewer, because the viewer doesn't identify with anyone else on that sitcom, so they need someone who's there on behalf of the viewer, looking into this world on their behalf. That's how you write a thing. Now, of course, the two cats walk into a bar stories on this program are unscripted, so none of this applies really, except to say that you can't have two cats having a conversation together if you're making a show for humans. And I spent 10 minutes explaining that very well in the original take of this segment. I was very annoyed. I discovered I wasn't recording. That segment, in case you're interested, goes on for about 10 minutes and it ends with me going, ah, no, fuck. I know what you're thinking there. You're thinking, wait a minute. Did he just say no mechanic is going to help you with that? You're thinking, well, I know a mechanic who's great. I have a great mechanic. I have a great mechanic. I'll give you his name. I'll give you his name if you like. I'll give you his name. He's great. He's great at stuff like that. You have two cars that have been glued together. What he does is he separates them first, and then he goes and, like a forensic used car detective, he goes online and he figures out where those two half cars came from, and he finds out where the other halves have gone. He matches it up with the owner of the other halves, and he arranges some sort of a swap so you can get the front of your car back with the back of their car and the back of their car back with the front of your car that it originally belongs to. And he does this for a nominal fee, and you think it's great, and you're going to highly recommend him. Well, you're confused there. You've confused the mechanic with your drug dealer. That's a drug dealer. And the reason I know it's a drug dealer is because you have that thoughts about what he's doing. He's not doing that. He's a drug dealer. He sells you drugs. And he says, so, if you're happy with the results, tell a friend. It's a fucking weird drug dealer as well. He's not supposed to say, tell people about this. He's not supposed to say, go and tell that fella on that podcast you listen to tell everyone that I'm an illegal car welder, unwelder, car matcher or something. No. What use is that to him? This publicity isn't helping him at all. He doesn't want people ringing him up saying, oh, I've heard you can glue cars back together when they've been glued to a different car. You can find the original half, match them up again, and find whoever got sold the other half. This was recommended to me by someone who was listening to a podcast and had this advice and somehow contacted me by, I don't know, perhaps submitting a message to the host who brought her up on a later show, which would show a lot more organization on my part than you should expect here, for one thing. Your drug dealer isn't going to want you to do that. People contacting him about their cars, that doesn't help him at all. So, he's a drug dealer. He's not, he doesn't, wait a minute though. How do drug dealers publicize themselves without getting into trouble? Maybe they do the car thing. Maybe it's the lingo, because I don't know the drug. Do they have a lingo where you go, oh, if you like my car mechanic service, nod, nod, wink, wink, please tell your friends. And you go and tell your friends, oh, I heard you have a problem with your car, nod, nod, wink, wink. Well, I know a man who can separate the two halves of the car that you have, and he'll find whatever sucker bought the other halves of the car. They're probably even in a worse state, but they'll be in a better state if they're matched up with the half of the car to which they originally belonged. My mechanic can help you with that. And that's the code for whatever drug the kids are doing now. I really, really need to find the correct other half of my car tonight. I need it now. I also need some munchies. Can you do that for me? I suppose there is that. If you are genuinely a car owner, and, well, you're a two-car owner now, you own two halves of a car, and you want a forensic mechanic who'll figure it all out for you, the last thing you should be doing is, I don't know what the last thing you should be doing. Maybe getting the last rites. I don't know. Well, the second last thing you should be doing. In fact, by last thing you should be doing, I mean you shouldn't be doing it at all. The last thing you should be doing is getting some fellow's number who deals with that shit. Because anyone who deals with that shit is not a proper mechanic. He's going to get you killed. Then you're dead. If he gets you killed, you're dead. No car matching service is going to sort that out. Maybe you've got another fella then who's also a drug dealer. But his stick is that he sticks people back together again after they've been killed by whatever I said that was. I've lost track of this segment. I don't know what the fuck it's about. You go to a mechanic and you tell them I've a front half of a car and the back half of a car and they're two different cars. They've been welded together and I've been sold a pup, basically. That's what they say. If you were sold something that was dodgy, it turned out not work. You say, I'd been sold a pup. Of course, nowadays, everyone buys puppies anyway. They say, oh, look, that's cute little puppies. I'll buy 12 of them. Does that one eat people's heads off? Oh, I'll have two of those. You don't see that with cats. No, people don't go, I want the most aggressive cat you have. I want to breed that cat. I want to have the most aggressive cat on the planet. I don't care if it's illegal. I don't care if that breed is being banned here. I think elsewhere in this episode I mentioned those kind of saber-toothed domestic cats that some people have. It's not really a wild cat, but it's some sort of crossbreed. Looks like your bog-standard domestic cat until, well, its ears are weird-looking, and then when it opens its mouth, it has fangs and blood coming out of it and sucks your blood or something, and it has a very angry snarl. You got a saber-toothed tiger, but it's being downsized. You go to a breeder. You say, I have this saber-toothed cat. I want it to have kittens. I want to give away the cat, but before it does that, I want it to have kittens. And I want to keep one of the kittens, and I want it to never grow up. It can mature, but not grow in size. But I want a bonsai saber-toothed cat. Can you sort that out for me, please, so I can live in the suburbs? I presume that's how they do it, is it? Maybe they don't. It's probably illegal. Where we keep our saber-toothed cats here in Ireland is you have a thing called Dublin Zoo. It's in the middle of a huge park in the middle of Dublin City. And next door to it is where we keep our president. Our official residence of the president is right next door to the zoo in this big city park. An oasis of greenery known as Phoenix Park in the middle of Dublin City. And then in the middle of that oasis of greenery, we have an oasis of captured endangered species behind bars. And then next door to that, we have the Bonsai White House. People go for walks in the Phoenix Park. And our current president, people are always seeing him out walking his dog in the part of the park that's behind his miniature White House. And he's miniature too. Our current president is a very small man. You look him up. You see rude foreigners say something about him being a leprechaun or something. And to be fair, part of it is that he has large dogs. So he's going to look small beside them anyway. But he is quite a small man and he's getting smaller because he's an octogenarian, I believe, now. His second and last term is coming to an end. I don't mean he's going to die. You're only allowed 2 terms now. He has a miniature White House because our presidents are not like your presidents. Ah, they're figureheads. They sign things and they're like the British Queen, except they're not royal. They're just normal, bog standard people. So they get a miniature White House beside the zoo. And it's great. Well, except when he says something about Israel being cunts or something. And half the world gets mad at him and then half of them go, he's great. And then the third half go, I thought he wasn't supposed to get involved in political controversies or have a point of view. And then the fourth half say, excuse me, not wanting to kill people is not a political point of view. And then the fifth half will say, that's a political point of view. And then the sixth half will say, wait a minute, there's not 6 halves of the electorate. Of course, the fifth half then says, who cares? Now, a few years ago, we had a presidential election where 3 of the 5 candidates were dragons. And this needs some explaining. Or I could just leave it there and not explain it at all. But no, I won't do that. There's a program called Shark Tank. And there's a program in England called Dragon's Den. And there's an Irish version of Dragon's Den. And the dragons are these really successful business people. Contestants come on and pitch their new business looking for investments from the dragons. And there was a presidential election here. The election before last, I think, 3 of the 5 candidates were current dragons of the Irish version of Dragon's Den. And then the 4th candidate was the current president. And then the 5th president was a Donald Trump wannabe. So they all had that election. It was great. They picked a, thankfully, no. Let's not get political on this program. No. It's perfectly fine to have 3 dragons from the same millionaire game show as candidates running against each other in a presidential election that only has 5 candidates, including the present incumbent. Nothing unhealthy about that at all, so let's leave it at that. It's perfectly fine. Nothing to see here. Nothing to see here. There's an ice cream van just going by in the neighbourhood now. I've never seen the ice cream van in this neighbourhood, but that doesn't surprise me. We moved here about 4 years ago, and in the previous town where we lived, there was an ice cream van that used to come round almost all year round. I think maybe it took Christmas off. It used to come around. It would come around every time from February to December or something. It would come around several times a day. It would come into our cul-de-sac with the music blaring and then immediately turn around. He do a U-turn in our cul-de-sac. I wouldn't be surprised if he was accelerating into the U-turn so he could turn around even faster. I don't know how any child ever stopped that van. I tried to stop it once. It was already on its way back to its den, back to its lair when I go out to the road. No, people like to say that these ice cream vans are just covers for drugs businesses. I don't want to allege that about anyone, especially about a van that I've never seen. All I know about this alleged van is that it makes a nice musical sound. It sounds very like what I used to call a toy radio. It's one of those things where you keep it beside the cot and when they put you to bed, your parents wind up this little toy radio thing and it plays a nice melodic sweet lullaby type music for a minute or two to lull you to sleep. I had 2 of those, in fact. The first one I had, I considered that to be a toy radio. And then I got a new one that had it was a big thing and had a kind of a screen. There was a scene on it that would scroll by. It was like watching a moving billboard scroll by in front of you. So I used to refer to that as my toy radio with pictures. As a stupid child, it never occurred to me to call it a toy television. No, I called it a toy radio with pictures. And that's all I'm seeing. All I know of the existence of the ice cream van in this neighbourhood is the music that comes out of it. So for all I know, it could be a toy ice cream van. I don't know. I'll go out there. I'll probably go out and find. There's no window on the side. It's just a scrolling picture of a scene or something. There's this game I used to play. Was it Guess Who or some sort of board game? Came with these cutout figures. They were like plastic cutouts representing each person who was under suspicion or something. So you'd have plastic flat cutout picture of a milkman and he'd be on a little stand. So you could put him on the table on the board standing up. A 2D model of a person. So you had a milkman and a doctor and a burglar and whatever else you have. That's what I imagine is on the side of that van. Instead of a window, there is a fake picture of a window and then there's people like that on it, stuck to the window or something to make it look like an innocent ice cream serving scene. What would it look like if there was drugs? Would it look different? I don't know. Would they dress differently? You might as well just not disguise it. Have the music by all means, but don't do anything to disguise the selling that's going on through that window. All you have to do is make it look like they're taking an ice cream. You don't have to disguise anyone. If the whole idea is that you're pretending you're buying an ice cream, then there's no need to do anything except look like you might be carrying an ice cream. Nobody can get to the van to make a purchase except for the drug buyers. So they're only going to see you from a distance. I'm never going to see that van close up. I'm only going to see it from my front door as I try to make a run for it to catch the van before it leaves the road. And I'm never going to catch it. So there's no need to worry about what it looks like close up. I'm only going to see a vague scene of someone at the window finishing a sale. I'm not going to see that they're not holding an ice cream or anything, so it's just going to look as innocent, no matter if it's selling drugs or ice cream. All you need is the music. So how does the van know to wait for the people who are coming out? Does it know which ones are drug purchasers and which ones are soon to be disappointed ice cream wanters? I don't, maybe it's the same thing. Maybe everyone who goes to the ice cream, I haven't thought about it this way before. Maybe everyone who runs out to catch the ice cream van has just got it in their mind that, oh, look, either the ice cream man or the drugs dealer is here. Whichever it is, I don't mind. I'll just go out, and if it's the ice cream van, I'll get some ice cream. And if it's the drugs van, I'll get some drugs. And either way, I'll be just as happy. I'm getting a treat today. It could be either drugs or ice cream. I'll find out when I get to the window, and it'll be great either way. Maybe they just don't know. Well, if I adopted that attitude, I never managed to get to the van on time, so I'm going to be disappointed either way. Maybe they have an arrangement. People book it. They say, oh, I want to book your ice cream van for a visit to my road at 3 o'clock this afternoon. And if I pay you an extra 20, which the drugs probably cost significantly more than the ice cream, so they just have to say, an extra 20 if you stop in my road for long enough for me to come out. And then what happens if one of the kids who thinks it's just an ice cream van manages to get to the window in that time? I suppose the ice cream man just has to make sure to tell his drug dealer customers that if you get to the van and there's a child in front of you, don't harm the child or anything, but push your way to the front of the queue so I can serve you and then get out of there. Don't worry about offending the child or being rude or anything. Just push your way to the front of the queue, because otherwise I'll have to drive away because I don't actually have ice creams for these people. These small people who are paying significantly less than you for their purchase. I suppose that's how they do it. Is that how they do it? I don't know who I'm asking. Maybe that's who they do. I suppose I'm just asking me, the future me who's listening back to this and digesting this new thought I've had. I'll probably spend the next several years digesting this new thought, or the next however many years I'm going to live in this relatively new neighbourhood. By the time I move again, I've no plans to move again. So let's say 20 years from now, I'm moving into some old age home, and then I'll be doing a podcast and thinking back about how the ice cream vans works in this neighbourhood. I'll have it long enough to think about it then, and then maybe I'll have more to say about it. Will I be able to record in the old folks' home? I don't know. Will I want to? Do people do podcasts in the old folks' home? I don't like to think too much about that, because when I think about stuff like that, my first thought is, Christ, they probably don't even have proper internet in those places. I've been to nursing homes. Nobody seems to have internet there. Or maybe they have it in the office. But if you're a resident, you're not working in the office. Maybe you can steal it from somewhere. I don't know. Doesn't really bear thinking about, does it? No. I mean, I know we're all going to die someday. And I know a lot of us are going to have to go to an old age home, a nursing home someday that doesn't have internet. Well, let's not think about that too much for now. Let's live in the present. I think we're coming to the end of this bottle of the dregs of a bottle of caffeine-free Diet Coca-Cola, which I've been using as my lubrication this afternoon. I've been in here quite some time. It's coming to the end of it. How normally, I don't necessarily judge when I'm finished recording by when we get to the end of this bottle of stuff. But as it happens, while I was in here, about half an hour into this session, I took the top off this bottle to take a sip. And I dropped the bottle top somewhere. It's on the floor somewhere in this room, and I'm never going to find it. Not least because I'm not going to look for it. I can't really see the floor, or I'll never find it. Never find it. It's not worth finding because there's about 2 inches of dregs left in the bottle anyway. But ideally, I'll finish this bottle at the exact time when I finish recording. I'd say there's maybe 2 mouthfuls left. So we'll see how much lubrication I need. And then when I get to the end of my lubrication, there'll probably be another 2 minutes of recording I can do after that before I go on fire from lack of lubrication. Is that what happens? If you don't lubricate yourself, you go on fire. I think that's what it is. Well, then what are fire hydrants for? You don't hydrate, you go on fire because you're not lubricated. But there's fire hydrants. So hydration for fire, but also you should keep hydrated so you don't go on fire. That doesn't make sense to me at all. Whoever's telling you to keep hydrated because you might go on fire, I think they might have mixed up 2 pieces of advice that they heard somewhere, maybe in a civics class in school. I remember not being taught civics in school. It was very interesting. The first 2 years of secondary school, we had a teacher for English 5 times a week. And then the same teacher was scheduled to teach us something called civics once a week. She decided not to teach us civics and just to use that as an extra English lesson each week. And for some reason, that wasn't considered a massive crime. She wasn't sent to jail for denying us our civics education. Everyone was just fine with it. Well, I'm not fine with it. I know nothing about civics now because of that. You'll notice elsewhere in this programme, I struggle to a segment where I try to explain what our president does or how our president is elected in this country. And it's not just the same as any other president. We have a figurehead president who works differently from other countries that have presidents. So I can't just watch the West Wing and gleam it from that. No. If I had got that civics class, that was back in around 1990. Even if I had done that class, if we hadn't been denied our civics education, it would be well out of date by now, because that was before we had recycling wheelie bins, or it's before we had that thing where you have to save your bottles and bring them back to that hellhole Lidl, to that machine where you put them in to get your deposit back. Probably bought in different types of voting as well. Any civics I would have learned back there would be well out of date by now, but at least I'd have had a foundation. I could have used that as a basis and updated myself by doing a Google about the bins and things. Just as I did back in around the mid-2000s, I did a night course in how to make a website. I learned how to make a website that looked like something that was made in the 1970s by a 5-year-old. Well, at least I'm able to do that. I'm able to make a website that looks like it was made by a 5-year-old in the 1970s. And I've built upon that since. I've figured out how to bring it into the 80s for the last 20 years. So it's a foundation. At least I knew where to start. I do remember that teacher. She was off one day. She was off sick or something, and a substitute teacher came in. It was a student teacher. And all the stuff that normally happens when there's a substitute teacher happens. And then when the English teacher came back the next day, she came in and she said, "I understand there was a difficulty with yesterday's class. If there is a difficulty again, the following will happen." And she went off on her barrage. And that was the first time in my life that I'd ever seen in the wild someone doing the quotation marks thing with their fingers. She lifted up her hands. She did the quotation marks. She used her forefinger and second finger on each hand to make the motion that looked like she's holding up quotation marks. She says, "I understand there was a quotation marks difficulty," close quotation marks. I don't think she did a different symbol for the close quotation marks. She just did a full set of quotation marks each time, which is grammatically not accurate, but it gets the message across, I suppose. I don't think there were any more difficulties in that class because the next time, I think the next time they just got someone else, I don't know. I wonder, did she go to the substitute teacher and say, I understand there was a difficulty. What the fuck is wrong with you? I had to go and tell the kids that their difficulty was them, when in actual fact it was you. You're unable to control a class of 14-year-olds for half an hour while you teach them their own language. What's wrong with you? Just go in, open the Shakespeare book, tell them, here's Henry IV, part one. We're going to read this for 2 years. And by the end of it, you're going to have not a clue what happened. How do people? I come across adults nowadays on podcasts and on TV and things who somehow manage to grow up with an appreciation of Shakespeare, despite having gone to one of these schools where everyone is forced at gunpoint to study these hideous books in the most boring way every afternoon while the sun is splitting the rocks through the window in some hellhole classroom. They're all studying. They sit there, they line us up with our Shakespeare books. You get the one Shakespeare book that you learn for the first 3 years of secondary school. And then you get another Shakespeare book that you do for the last 2 years. Every day you come in, he says, right, you've all read these two pages last night. You're all going to read a paragraph each. And the rest of you are going to sit there listening. And we're going to learn to love Shakespeare by doing that. How in the name of Christ are there adults who grew up the same era as me in classes like that who actually like Shakespeare? What is wrong with you? The same goes for Wuthering Heights and Great Expectations. That was almost as bad, as these they were written in somewhat discernible English. So you knew something was going on. There was this fella, Heathcliff. In those days, there was a cartoon called Heathcliff on the television here. It was a bit like Garfield, except it was Heathcliff. I don't think that was based on the classic novel, but we did study Great Expectations. Wait, was Great Expectations Heathcliff, or was that Wuthering Heights? I'm not sure. There's a fella called Pip in Great Expectations. Earlier on in the book, someone asked him his name, and Pip goes, Pip, Pip, sir. Our second cat, she was supposed to be called Philip, after one of my matchstick cats from my webcomic, where it turns out it was a female. So we called her Pippi. But that wasn't named after the cat in Wuthering Heights. And neither was the matchstick cat, Philip. He wasn't named after Pip from Wuthering Heights, or from Great Expectations, rather. So I wonder how I got to that point where I could name a cat Pippi and not associate it at all with that fucking god-awful book that we were made to study in school. Because if I had realised the connection, I would never have recommended to my wife naming her second cat Pippi or anything along the lines of Pip. No, well, it never occurred to me at the time. I just thought we're naming it after Philip, my matchstick cat. And when I was naming my matchstick cat Philip, I'm pretty sure I didn't name it after Pip from Great Expectations. So how did that happen? I don't know. It's probably just something wrong with my brain, a mixed connection, I don't know. Anyway, good morning.